It was ironic. His grandfather had spent his entire life building trains, and his father committed suicide by one. Paul had big plans. He would not end up like his father or grandfather. He would not spend his entire life making ends meet. He would be the master of his fate. He would build a company from the ground up, and it would make him enough money to take care of his family for generations. He did just that. His software company at one point was recording sales of over $1 million a month. There was hope they could double or triple their earnings the next year. But then everything started to go in the wrong direction. The mobile company, which heavily pushed their apps, started to lose market share and soon was struggling to keep a foothold in the industry. Other mobile makers suddenly adopted new operating systems. His company's biggest mistake was not making their apps compatible for all platforms. By the time they made the changes, it was too late. Consumers had moved on to other apps that were far more advanced than theirs. His company began to spend more than they were bringing in. Whatever cash flow reserves they had were used to update the apps. They became a casualty of an ever-changing technology industry. Against his mother's advice, he had gone ahead and married Sharon. In hindsight, he should have been skeptical of the unexpected pregnancy, but there was a reason beyond having a baby that made him do it. Sharon's father had offered to pay for their wedding, and he had also agreed to extend him a loan to fund his new business. He needed a leg up to make his dreams come true. And with no bank willing to give him the money he desperately needed, he accepted his father-in-law's help. He sighed. I was supposed to have the perfect family and the perfect life. How did it all fall apart? He thought. The chants started again. They were even louder than before. He closed his eyes and tried to drown out the noise, even though he knew it was a futile gesture. Chapter 72. Calloway was at Evan Roth's office. Roth was not pleased that he had to hand over materials on a case to a third party, but on his client's instructions, he was forced to oblige. He pushed a file across his desk. "I had my secretary make a copy for you," he said. "It contains everything the prosecution had on the case so we could prepare our rebuttal." Calloway lifted the file. It was thick and heavy. "I'm not sure if you'll find anything useful in there," Roth said.
"Probably not, but I still want to take a look."
He moved his fingers across the file, as if by doing so he might conjure up something vital inside.
"You know they want to charge Paul with the death penalty," Roth said.
"I know," Calloway replied. "But what I don't understand is why are you abandoning him at this time?"
Roth looked offended.
"I'm not abandoning him. I'm trying to help him."
"By advising him to plead guilty?" Calloway asked.
"Each day that goes by, new evidence surfaces that has so far not helped Paul. When I took on the case, the prosecution had a plea deal on the table. It was for 15 years with a chance of parole at 8, which is what I'm still trying to get for Paul. As time has passed, the prosecution's case has gotten stronger, and they are now less inclined to an offer favorable to him. I'd be lucky if I can get him 25 years with a chance of parole at 15. I'll keep at it, but I doubt they'll budge much now."
Roth paused a moment.
"You have spoken to Paul. Do you know if he is going to plead guilty?"
"He didn't say anything to me."
Calloway did not want to tell Roth that that was what Paul was considering at this point. Roth said,
"When I take on a new case, I never ask my client whether he did it or not. All I ask are the facts. Based on those facts, I see whether I can win the case or not. In Paul's case, I didn't. It doesn't help me when my client has no memory of what happened on the night of the murder. I can't argue that he was not at the scene of the crime when he clearly was. I can't argue that the blood on him was not the victim's when, in fact, it was. I can't even argue that he did not commit the crime when the murder weapon was found in his vehicle and his fingerprints were all over it. I can try to build a case around the fact that he may have suffered a psychotic episode that propelled him to act in a violent manner. But that requires Paul to be analyzed by psychiatrists and other medical professionals. It is a long, drawn-out process to identify what his mental state was at the time of the crime. I don't know if he is prepared for that, or if he has the financial resources to go down that route.
If you knew the case was unwinnable from the beginning, then why did you take it on?
Calloway asked. Roth shook his head. I did it for the Lester family. I've known them for years. Baron and Richard are my firm's best and oldest clients. When Paul was taken into custody, I received a call from Baron to get his son-in-law out. At that time, the Lester family thought it was all a mistake. They believed Paul was innocent and that there was no way he could have hurt Kyla.
But now they have changed their view on that, Calloway said.
In light of the recent evidence, yes, they have.
Are they pushing you to convince Paul to plead?
Yes and no. They want this matter behind them as soon as possible. They have made this known through the media as well. But I also think it's a smart decision now for Paul to take a deal if it's on the table. He's still relatively young. By the time he gets out on parole, he can still rebuild his life.
What if he is innocent? Calloway asked.
Roth's head fell to his chest.
If he went to prison for a crime he didn't commit, then I have failed him as his lawyer.
Chapter 73. Calloway took the file Roth had given him and headed straight for the nearest diner. He found a seat in the back of the restaurant. He ordered coffee, extra strong, and he told the waitress to top up the cup whenever it was almost empty. He would need the caffeine to help him get through the file because there was a lot of material. Photos from the crime scene, statements from witnesses and the accused, notes from the detectives, lab reports, and even the medical examiner's analysis. After 2 hours and 6 cups of coffee, a couple of things stood out to him. The first was the position Kyla was found in the bedroom. She lay in the bed with her arms resting next to her body on either side. Her head faced the ceiling with her eyes closed. If one were to ignore the blood, they would assume she was sleeping. Then there were the clothes she was wearing. They were not sleeping attire. She was dressed as if she was ready to go out. Was she preparing to run away? Perhaps with Pedro? But Calloway could not find anything in the file to indicate that she had packed her bags for such a trip, so that theory did not hold. Next was the autopsy report. It stated that Kyla had died of asphyxiation, not from the stabbing. If it was the other way around, blood would be everywhere. Another thing that caught his attention was the knife found in the glove compartment of Paul's car. The knife's tip was clean, while the rest of the blade was covered in blood. It did not make sense because Kyla's body was full of puncture wounds, which could only have come from the knife being thrust directly into her body. The last thing that made him pause was the blood stain on Paul's golf shirt. It was a long, smooth streak, not drops splattered all over. It was also on the back of the shirt, not the front. It would make more sense during an altercation for the blood to spray on the front of the shirt, but there was not a single drop there. Calloway's eyes narrowed. A theory began to form in his head. It seemed far-fetched, and if he told someone what it was, they would laugh him out of the room. But it was all he had to go on with right now. The waitress came over to top up his cup for the 7th time. He put his hand over the cup. "I'm done," he said. She looked relieved. "I was kind of worried you would keep going. You sure you don't want anything to eat? It would help with all that coffee in your system." He thought a moment. "You know what? I am kind of hungry." She smiled. "We have the cheeseburger special today. It comes with fries and your choice of drink. I would recommend anything but another cup of coffee."
"Yeah, that sounds good. And I'll get plain water with it."
"Coming right up."
He pulled out his cell phone and sent a quick email. Chapter 74. Calloway returned to his office. The first thing he did was turn on his laptop. Back at the diner, he had taken his time with the special the waitress brought for him. The cheeseburger was the best he had tasted in a long time. Maybe it had a lot to do with the amount of coffee he had consumed. Once the caffeine wore off, he was famished. He savored each bite of the burger, and the fries were just right, not too crispy and not too soggy. He checked his watch as the laptop booted up. He hoped enough time had passed for the recipient of the email to check her message. When he signed into his browser, he smiled. There was a reply from Echo Rose. Calloway had met her in Fairview when he had gone there to follow up on a lead for another case. She had wanted to hire him for a job. He turned it down because the information was decades old. He did not think he would be able to complete the job. But then he found himself in a bind, and it was only when she put her life on the line that he was able to solve his case. He then gave his full attention to solving her problem. Last he heard from Echo, she was grateful for his help. He now needed her help. Echo was not only resourceful, but also had a way with computers. One could say she was an amateur hacker. He clicked open the email. Echo's message contained the usernames and passwords to various online accounts and social media sites. They all belonged to Kyla Gardner. Calloway was not sure how Echo managed to find them on such short notice. He was just thankful that she did. He punched in the address of a social media website and signed into Kyla's account. The first thing he noticed were the heartfelt messages of sadness from friends, classmates, and even strangers. He assumed they were strangers because next to their names were icons to request friendship. They were not clicked, so Kyla most likely did not know them or did not want to befriend them. He scrolled past the individual messages, tributes, and poems that pretty much summed up that she was loved and would be missed forever. He scrolled all the way back to the day she had died. He then slowly went through each of her posts. There were dozens. Why do young people think anyone would be interested in what they did each and every minute of the day? He wondered. While working as a private investigator, Calloway had become aware of the dangers online. If you posted anything, no matter how mundane or obscure, it was forever available to those who wanted to find it. Calloway found copious amounts of dirt on clients' spouses just by conducting a simple online search. And if he had Echo skills, it would cut his work by half. He would not even have to leave the office in some cases. He could do all his work with his fingers. The naivete people displayed when they assumed their lives were hidden to strangers online was baffling. Anyone with even the most basic computer knowledge could find out whatever they wanted about you. And it had become even easier now that everything contained a computer chip. You did not even have to hack a cell phone or computer. You could hack the computer system of a vehicle and find out where the individual commuted to each day. You could hack into the thermostat of a home and find out where someone lived. The possibilities were endless. He was scrolling through the lists of posts when his eyes fell on one. On the day of her death, Kyla had teased that she was going to be making a big announcement. Calloway believed the announcement was either about her pregnancy or that she was getting married soon. The post had a dozen thumbs-up responses. He clicked on the post to see who liked it. He spotted Pedro's name in the list. No surprise there. He was about to move to the next post when he saw there was one thumbs down. He clicked the image, and a profile photo appeared on the screen. The man's eyes were hidden behind dark sunglasses, and his face was tilted to the side, as if he was looking away from the camera. Calloway jotted down his name. The social media site also had a feature where users could tag all the places they had visited on a particular day. The users' visits showed up on a map with tiny red dots. If you clicked on the dot, a post or photo would appear, depending on what the user chose to provide. Calloway began to make notes of all the places Kyla had visited. He was going to retrace her steps on that fateful day. Chapter 75. Calloway was back at the safe injection clinic. "That was quick," Calloway said to the medical professional. "I requested a fast turnaround," the man said. "I figured you needed it for a job." "I did." The man handed him the test results. "Whoever your client was, they had some serious stuff in their system." Calloway suspected the medical professional might have guessed the client was Paul Gardner, but he was not worried the test results would leak to the press. Whoever came to the clinic, addict or not, their privacy was strictly protected. If the authorities suddenly decided to raid the clinic, they would find nothing. The clinic never asked the addicts their real name. Calloway scanned the test results. His mouth dropped. He looked up at the medical professional in disbelief. "Rohypnol?" Calloway asked. "That's what they found in the blood sample you left." Rohypnol, a.k.a. the date rape drug, was initially created to treat insomnia, but it began to show up as a recreational drug at clubs, raves, and music festivals. Calloway knew that when this drug was administered for sinister purposes, it could render a person not only unconscious, but also cloud a victim's memory. "Is this why Paul's memory about that night is foggy?" Calloway wondered. "That would explain a lot." According to Holt and Fisher's notes, Paul showed signs of confusion, sluggishness, and looked hungover. They attributed this to the bottle of scotch found in the guest house. What they failed to realize was that these were all signs of Rohypnol poisoning. Calloway resumed reading the test results. His eyes widened. "Chloroform?" he said. The medical professional nodded. "When you said your client had blacked out and did not remember anything, I requested that the tests focus on certain chemicals. As you can see, there was a high chloroform concentration in the blood." "All I know is it knocks people out, but I'm not too familiar with it as a drug." "Throughout history, chloroform was used for its anesthetic purposes, but because of its high volatility, its use was discontinued. It's colorless, and it's sweet-smelling."
"Did you say sweet?" Calloway asked.
"Yeah, people have said it smelled sweet."
"And you're sure it was in his system?" Calloway asked.
"If the sample you brought us belonged to your client, then yes. Your client came into contact with those chemical agents."
Chapter 76. When Calloway explained the results of the drug test over the phone, Paul had no idea how any of them could have gotten in his body. He was horrified at the mere thought of it. Calloway was certain Paul had not taken them on his own volition. He did not come across as the type of guy who partied hard at night or consumed recreational drugs. But he was under a lot of stress. His marriage was falling apart, and his business was struggling. So he could have consumed Rohypnol to ease the tension. But there was no explanation for why he would have chloroform in his body. It just did not make any sense. But one thing was for sure. Paul was telling the truth when he said he did not remember anything from that night. In order to solve how Paul might have gotten these drugs in him, Calloway had to go back to the scene of the crime. As he drove up, he was surprised to see no press outside the Gardner residence. He was sure some reporters would have camped out on the front lawn, just in case something turned up. The front door was covered with yellow police tape, but Calloway was not interested in the house. He was interested in what was behind it. He took the side path until he was confronted by a wooden gate. It was locked. He peeked through the side opening. He could see the bolt. He searched his surroundings and found a tree branch on the ground. He stripped it of leaves and protruding twigs and stuck it between the gate's openings. He then gently lifted the bolt. The gate swung open. He entered the backyard. He headed straight for the guest house. Fortunately, there was no police tape on the door. That still did not mean what he was doing was lawful, however. He was breaking and entering. Calloway did not care. An innocent man's life was on the line. He pulled on a pair of gloves and turned the door handle. He smiled. Whoever was here last had not bothered to lock the door. Maybe they did not think anything useful was left in the guest house. Big mistake, Calloway thought. The guest house is the key to this mystery. He entered and took in the space. He spotted the futon in the corner that Paul had slept on. There was an empty spot next to it. The recliner had been tagged and taken away as evidence. Kyla's blood was on the recliner. It could have gotten on it from Paul's shirt. Across from the empty spot was a coffee table. It, too, was empty. The bottle of scotch and glass would be used to prove that Paul was drunk that night when he attacked and killed Kyla. Calloway looked around.
He was not sure what he was hoping to find, but it had to be here. He then noticed a window next to the spot where the recliner used to sit. He walked up to the window and moved his hand around it. He felt something at the bottom. He leaned down and saw the window was slightly open. Air was seeping through the crack. No wonder the room feels so cool, he thought. He left the guest house and walked around the structure. There was a narrow path between the guest house and the next-door neighbor's property. Calloway was easily able to squeeze through it and make it to the window. He pulled out a flashlight and shined the light on the ground. He spotted a partial footprint hidden by leaves and broken twigs. Someone had accessed the guest house window from the outside. Who did that? He thought. Chapter 77. Calloway left the guest house and walked back to his car. He spotted a man standing in the driveway. He was wearing a light jacket, jeans, and a baseball cap. There was something odd about the way he stood there. He did not come across as someone who was curious to check out the house where a father had allegedly murdered his daughter. It looked as if the man was paying his condolences. The moment he spotted Calloway, he turned and began walking in the other direction. Calloway decided to follow him. The man turned and saw Calloway behind him. He quickened his steps. Calloway did the same. The man crossed the road and hurried toward a green vehicle, parked on the side of the street. Calloway did not want to lose him. He went into a full jog. The man bolted. He must have realized he did not have enough time to get inside the car and drive away. Damn, Calloway thought and ran after him. The man raced down the street and disappeared around the corner. Calloway made it to the end. He saw the man was already making his way up the steep incline of the adjacent street. Calloway's legs burned as he kept up the chase. He was panting as he made it to the end of the street. He looked around, but the man was nowhere to be seen. He thought about turning back. He could always get the license plate number of the green vehicle and locate the name of the owner. But a part of him was angry that he had lost the man. He was about to double back when he spotted the man at the far end of the street. He was cutting through a park, making his way toward a tunnel that went underneath a road. From his vantage point, Calloway estimated the man was 30 yards away. He suddenly had an idea. If the tunnel had an entrance, it must have an exit. He had to find where this exit was. He hurried down another street. This one traversed an even steeper incline, but it went downhill. Calloway made it to the end and cut right. He narrowly missed running into an old woman with a walker. He apologized and kept going. He was nearly out of breath and sweating profusely when he reached the other side of the tunnel. He looked around. The man was not there. Damn! Am I late? Did I miss him? His mouth was dry, his throat was parched, and it felt like his lungs were on fire. He should have just gone back to the green vehicle and waited for the man to return. Calloway heard a noise coming from the tunnel. He could not see who it was because of the darkness, but he could tell the sound was feet hitting pavement. He moved to the side of the entrance and waited as the footsteps became louder and more distinct. The man emerged from the tunnel, not seeing Calloway as he hurried by. Calloway took three long strides and tackled the man from behind. The man fell forward and hit the ground. The baseball cap flew off his head. Calloway turned the man so he was facing him and cocked his fist. The man put his hands over his face. "Please don't hurt me," he pleaded. "What were you doing outside the Gardner residence?"
"I didn't do anything."
"Answer my question, or else I'll take you down to the police," Calloway said.
"I am Kyla's father," the man replied.
"What?" Calloway asked, confused.
"I am Kyla's real father."
Chapter 78. The man's baseball cap had hidden a bald pate. His hands were big and calloused, and there was dirt underneath his fingernails. His eyes were blue, and they darted from one spot to another as if looking out for any sign of danger. His name was Gus Holden, and he lived 100 miles from Milton. Calloway had felt bad for scaring Holden, so he offered to buy him a drink. They could not find a bar nearby, so they grabbed a seat at a cafe's patio. Why did you run away when you saw me? Calloway asked. Holden took a sip of his drink.
I don't know. I wasn't expecting anyone to catch me.
And why were you worried about anyone catching you?
Holden looked away. He looked like he did not want to say too much.
Calloway needed answers, and he was not about to let this man go without getting some.
I'm trying to find out what happened to Kyla, Calloway said. So whatever you tell me might help me do just that.
I saw you on TV, Holden said instead.
TV?
Yeah, you were leaving Paul Gardner's house. I know you're helping my daughter's killer.
He didn't kill your daughter.
Holden's eyes gleamed with surprise.
He didn't?
No, and I'm going to prove it.
Holden suddenly looked relieved.
I never believed the news when I heard it.
Have you met Paul?
Once.
And?
Holden was silent again.
Calloway leaned closer.
Listen, right now I have no idea what's going on. But what I do know is that a man may get the death penalty for a crime he never committed. So let's start with a few simple questions, okay?
Holden nodded.
Why haven't you come forward and told everyone Kyla's your real daughter?
I can't.
Why not? He sighed.
I was paid never to tell anyone she was my child.
Calloway blinked. What?
Yes.
Who paid you?
Holden hesitated a moment.
Baron Lester, he whispered.
Senator Lester?
Yes.
Why would he do that?
It was a long time ago, he said. Sharon and I were young. I met her at a rock concert. I was there with my friends, and she was there with hers. We started talking during the sets, and I was immediately attracted to her. At the end of the concert, I asked her out for drinks. I was surprised when she agreed. I could tell she came from a wealthy family. She drove a nice car, and she had on expensive jewelry. My dad owned an automotive garage, and I worked there as a mechanic. So money was always tight. Anyway, we went to a bar and drank. We then went to my apartment, where we did pot. And then one thing led to another. When I woke up the next morning, she was gone. I didn't pay too much attention to it, but a couple of days later, or maybe it was a week, I don't remember, Sharon showed up at my dad's garage. I think she saw a business card in my apartment, and she knew I was a mechanic, so it wasn't hard for her to find me. She told me she was pregnant. She said she came from a conservative family, and when they found out, they'd kill her. She said I had to marry her. I was scared. I didn't know what to do. But I told her I would speak to my father, and it'd all be all right. He paused and took a sip from his cup. Before I could get the courage to tell my dad, I got a visit from Sharon's father. He wasn't a senator at the time, but I could tell he liked being in control. Sharon told him what had happened, and he wasn't pleased by it. In fact, he looked so agitated that I thought he would hit me. Instead, he said he had an offer for me. If I agreed to never see Sharon again and tell no one I was the child's father, he would pay me a large sum.
How much? Calloway asked.
Holden lowered his head.
$100,000.
And I bet you took it.
I didn't see any other choice. I didn't want to be a father, and I didn't want to get married either. I was still young. Plus, I needed the money. My dad's garage had a lot of loans on it, and I wanted to help him out. I met a lawyer. I don't remember his name. I signed a document, and I walked away with a check for a lot of money. I'm not sure what they told Sharon, but I know she felt abandoned. So she married Paul Gardner, and they told him Kyla was his child.
Then what happened? Calloway asked.
I regretted what I did the moment I took the money, but it was too late. If I went back on the agreement, the lawyer would have sued me and taken my dad's garage away. So instead, I kept my distance. But every once in a while, I would check up on her.
You mean Kyla?
He nodded.
I followed her a few times. I know it sounds creepy, but I needed to be sure she was being taken care of. And by the looks of it, she was.
You said you had met Paul once, Calloway said. When was this?
It was maybe when Kyla was 10. I faked car trouble by the side of the road. I knew Paul would be driving by around that time. I wanted to see what kind of man he was. To my surprise, he stopped and tried to assist me. He had no idea I knew more about cars than he did. He then called a tow truck and waited with me for it to show up. During this time, I got to talk to him. I asked about his family. My real motive was to know about Kyla. I could see the pride and joy in his eyes whenever he spoke of her. That's when I knew I had nothing to worry about. But when I heard about her death, I was devastated. I wanted to go see her, but I knew I couldn't. Senator Lester is not the man you see on TV. The man I met was cold and calculating. He would not only use our agreement against me, he would also make sure I was completely destroyed.
I don't see how he would be able to do that.
He could go to the media and tell them that I had sold my right as a parent for money. Plus, I have a family of my own now. I am married with two boys, so Kyla was my only girl. They have no idea of my past, and I don't want to drag them into this mess. It would devastate them, and it could destroy my marriage and my relationship with my sons. Holden choked up. I always hoped one day, when Senator Lester was gone, I would get an opportunity to tell Kyla the truth. Now that she is dead, that hope died with her.
Calloway could not help but feel sorry for Holden. He had made a decision he would regret for the rest of his life. After a brief pause, Calloway asked, "Before Kyla's death, who knew you were her real father?" Holden thought a moment. "Sharon, her father, and her brother."
Chapter 79. Fisher drove back to the station. She was able to catch up on her sleep, and she even managed to run some errands. Overall, it was a productive day. The Gardner investigation had come to its conclusion. Barrows would work out a deal with Roth, and the case would be closed. Holt was still miffed about this. After leaving Barrows' office, he had refused to answer Fisher's calls. He fervently believed they had a case to send Gardner away for life. Even the death penalty was a possibility if Barrows pushed for it. Holt was laying blame on the DA's office for not doing their job. They had an open-and-shut case, and they were caving into the defense's demands when the prosecution had the upper hand. Fisher understood Barrows was in a tight spot. She had to please her bosses, who were being pressured by Senator Lester to make this go away. On all the cases Fisher had worked on, she was certain of the guilt of the accused. In Paul Gardner's case, she was not so sure. All the evidence pointed in his direction, which made her suspicious. She could smell a setup from a mile away. But she had no proof to confirm her hunch. Plus, it was not her job to do so. The defense should have been on this from the beginning. They were not, which probably meant they knew Gardner was guilty. She made her way to her desk. Holt was waiting for her with a wide smile on his face. "Don't tell me," she said, shaking her head. "You found new evidence in the Gardner case."
"I did indeed."
"Really?" she asked, surprised. Holt waved a document in the air.
"The ballistics report came back."
"And?"
"The bullet found in Pedro Catano came from a 9mm Glock."
"Okay."
"Guess who else had a 9mm Glock registered to his name?"
Fisher sighed. "Paul Gardner."
"Bingo."
"But we searched the entire house and we didn't find any weapons."
"And you know why?"
he said.
"About a month ago, Gardner had reported the Glock missing. I'm guessing he had it on him the entire time."
"Then why didn't he just shoot Kyla with it? It would have been cleaner than stabbing her, and he would have avoided getting evidence on his clothes."
"I don't know. Maybe he's just dumb."
Fisher frowned. "This doesn't feel right."
"We don't base a case on feelings. We base them on the evidence we get."
She crossed her arms over her chest. "And that's coming from you?"
"I know you think this is personal to me, and maybe it is. But I know when to follow my gut. And my gut tells me Gardner murdered his daughter and her lover. This report further confirms this."
Fisher was silent.
"Listen," Holt said, "even if you don't agree with me, how do you explain Gardner owning a 9mm Glock and that the bullet found in Pedro was from a similar weapon?"
"I can't."
"Exactly," Holt said. He clenched his fist. "I'll be damned if Gardner gets a deal now."
Chapter 80
Calloway rang the doorbell and waited. A Filipino woman answered.
Yes?
She asked. Is Mrs. Sharon Gardner home? The woman hesitated. Tell her it's Lee Calloway. I work with her husband, Paul.
Please wait.
She closed the door behind her. Calloway turned and stared at the water fountain. On his drive over, he had spotted a couple of news vans parked on the side of the road. They did not dare enter the house's gates, lest they be charged with trespassing. He hoped that would not end up happening to him. He came here for a reason, and he did not want to leave without it. The door opened, and the Filipino woman said, "Please come in." He found Sharon waiting for him in the living room. She looked like she had not slept in weeks. Her eyes were red and puffy. Her skin was pale, and gray strands were visible in her hair. Both she and Paul had aged substantially from the time their daughter was found dead. Calloway did not know how he would go on if something were to happen to Nina. He was fully aware he had not given her enough of his time. He always figured he would make it up to her later. But if he was robbed of that opportunity, he was not sure he would go on with his life.
"I'm not supposed to talk to anyone,"
Sharon said. She did not offer Calloway a seat, nor did she sit. "I'm sorry for your loss," he said. She stared at him.
"Thank you."
"This must be a difficult time for you, so I'll keep it brief," he said. "I don't believe Paul killed your daughter." Her eyes became moist, and she bit down on her bottom lip. "Paul loved Kyla, and he would never harm her."
"Is that what he told you?" she asked.
"He did." She fell on the sofa and covered her face with her hands. For a second, Calloway thought Sharon would break down and cry. "Mrs. Gardner, I know this must be weighing heavily on you," he said, "so I'm giving you a chance to clear your conscience." She looked up. He could see it in her eyes. She desperately wanted to talk, but her family was preventing her from doing so.
"What do you want to know?"
"Did you know Kyla was pregnant?"
"No."
"Did anyone else in your family know she was?"
"I don't think so."
"Did you see anything between Kyla and Pedro?"
"Like what?"
"Like if they were romantically involved." She thought for a moment.
"I didn't pay too much attention to what was going on in her life. I was too busy with mine."
She shook her head. "When you came home from shopping that night," he said, "did you see Kyla?"
"No. I didn't bother to check her room. I was preoccupied with something else."
"Your late-night visit with Mr. Kenny Goldman?" She shot daggers at him, but then her eyes softened.
"You know, ever since Kyla's death, both of our lives have fallen apart. Kenny's wife has left him, and he's now living in a motel. I am alone, and I'm living in my brother's house."
Calloway did not want this interview to be about her tryst. He wanted to confirm some things, and he knew he did not have much time before she asked him to leave. "After your visit with Mr. Goldman, you came home, and then what did you do?"
"It was very late at night. I took some sleeping pills, and I went to bed."
"Did you see if Kyla's bedroom lights were on?"
She thought for a moment. "I don't think they were, or else I would have spoken to her about it."
"And during the night, did you hear any commotion coming from your daughter's room?"
"Even if there was anything, I wouldn't know because of the medication."
"So you have no idea if your daughter was home when you came back from your shopping, or when you returned from meeting Mr. Goldman?" She sighed.
"I don't."
Calloway pinched the bridge of his nose. Then he plunged into deep thought.
"How is Paul doing?" Sharon asked.
He was surprised she was concerned about him. All this time, she and her family were going in front of the cameras and playing the victim, while he was left to hide in his mother's house like a monster.
"I mean, how is he after he found out that Kyla isn't his?" Sharon said.
"He's devastated."
She lowered her head. "I didn't mean to hurt him, but I know I did. There were other men, but he still stuck with me. I think he did it because of Kyla. He loved her so much, and he couldn't bear the thought of not being a part of her life."
Calloway grimaced. "Nina's my child for sure, and yet I barely see her," he thought.
One last question, he asked. After you found Kyla in the bedroom, you went to the guest house to wake Paul up. Did you notice a smell? She looked baffled by his question.
Smell?
Yes, perhaps something sweet. Her brow furrowed.
I'm not sure if it was sweet. My mind was all over the place at that moment, but now that I think about it, I did smell something odd.
Chapter 81. Calloway was on his way back to his office when he received a call from Fisher. She explained the findings of the ballistics report.
Thanks, Dana, he said and hung up. Not good, he thought.
Not only would they charge Paul with Kyla's death, they would also tack on Pedro's as well. Whatever plea deal Paul was hoping to get was now out the window. Calloway could not see the prosecutor showing any leniency when it was a double homicide. He called Paul, but his phone went straight to voicemail. Calloway had a bad feeling in the pit of his stomach. He turned the car around and drove straight to Paul's mother's house. Calloway was not sure if the news had reached the press camped outside the house. It would soon enough. Something like that could only stay a secret for so long. An ambitious reporter would have to make one call to his contact in the Milton PD. And after sweetening their agreement, the contact would be more than willing to part with that information. Calloway parked behind a news van and got out. He did not bother trying to be low-key. He had more urgent matters to be concerned about. As expected, the press sensed something was up when they saw him rush toward the house. They descended on him, but with his head down, he pushed past them and moved up to the front porch. He banged his fist on the door and yelled, "It's Lee Calloway!" The door opened slightly. "I need to speak to Paul," Calloway said. Paul's mother held the door for him. He went inside and said, "Where is he?"
"He's upstairs in his room. His lawyer called, and after that, I don't know what happened. I'm worried he won't come out."
Calloway raced up the stairs and knocked on a door.
"Paul, it's Lee. Can I come in?"
There was no response. Calloway placed his ear to the door. He could hear movement inside. He knocked again. "Paul, we need to talk. I know you didn't kill Kyla. I even spoke to Sharon, and she doesn't think you did either."
The handle turned, and the door opened a crack. Calloway saw Paul peering out.
"You met Sharon?" Paul asked.
"I did, yes."
"And she believes I didn't do it?"
"She knows you loved Kyla like your own, and that you would never harm her. Now can I come inside and talk to you?"
The door swung open. The room was a mess. Clothes were on the floor, items were scattered all over. A lamp was on its side, and the furniture was in disorder.
"Do you have any weapons at home?" Calloway asked.
Paul looked at him confused.
"Do you have any guns?"
Paul shook his head. Calloway spotted a knife on the nightstand.
"You thinking about hurting yourself?" he asked.
Paul lowered his head and sat on the bed. After a brief pause, he said,
"I didn't kill Pedro."
"I know you didn't, but I need to know about the gun. It was registered to you."
"It was stolen."
"When?"
"About a month ago."
"Where did you keep it?"
"In a locked box."
"And what happened?"
"I came home one day and I couldn't find the box."
"Did you ask Sharon?"
"She had no idea."
"You believed her?"
"Yes, she had no reason to take it."
"Who else knew about the gun?"
"My father-in-law, Baron."
"Why did you tell him?"
"He was the one who encouraged me to get one."
"Why?"
"Baron supported a bill that would restrict the average person from owning military-grade firearms. Once he did, he started getting death threats."
"Does he own a gun?" Calloway asked.
Paul shook his head.
"No, because of the optics. The gun-loving public would call him a hypocrite. If he could buy a gun to protect himself, then why couldn't they?"
Calloway frowned. "But he was against owning military weapons, not regular weapons."
"It doesn't matter. You were either pro-gun or anti-gun. You were never in the middle, according to some people."
"When the Glock went missing, did you ask your father-in-law?" Calloway asked.
"Of course," Paul replied. "He told me to file a police report, which I did."
Paul's face contorted into a mask of dread.
The DA's office is ready to lay additional charges on me. Even if I manage to avoid the death penalty, I'll spend the rest of my life in prison. So what's the point of all of this?
Calloway looked him straight in the eye. If you hold tight and don't do anything stupid, I just might be able to get you out of this mess.
Chapter 82. Jay Buchwald worked at a cell phone kiosk in a shopping mall. He was tall with curly blonde hair, stubble on his chin, and studs in his ears. He was dressed in a dark blue uniform, and he was showing a smartphone to a middle-aged woman. Calloway had found Buchwald's name through Kyla's social media webpage. Buchwald had clicked thumbs down on her announcement post. When Calloway had reached out to him, Buchwald was more than willing to meet him. Calloway walked around the kiosk. The glass case had several cell phone models on display, along with their respective covers. A colleague of Buchwald's approached him to help. Calloway pointed to Buchwald, and the colleague understood and moved to the next customer. The middle-aged woman smiled whenever Buchwald showed her a feature on the phone. She agreed to purchase it. Buchwald quickly rang up the sale. He also managed to sell her a cell phone screen protector and cover. Buchwald turned to Calloway.
You're the PI, right?
I am. Calloway looked around the mall. Is there some place we can talk in private?
I have to grab lunch. The restaurants are on the first floor. You can join me, but I can't talk long. We get really busy at this time.
We'll talk on the way there. As they walked through the mall, Calloway said, When we spoke, you mentioned you had dated Kyla. How long ago was that?
We dated for over a year, but she broke it off abruptly. It was at least 3 months ago.
Calloway's brow furrowed. Kyla was 9 weeks pregnant, so the baby couldn't have been yours. Buchwald stopped.
When I saw it on the news, that's the first thing I thought of. I had no idea that she was even pregnant. But then when I did the math, I knew I couldn't be the father, you know?
Did Kyla ever talk about Pedro? Calloway asked.
Sure, she talked about him a lot. They were good friends.
Were they ever involved?
He shook his head almost violently.
Are you kidding me? That entire thing on the news about Kyla being pregnant with Pedro's child is all bullshit.
So it wasn't true?
Of course not. Kyla was an only child. She had no siblings of her own, so Pedro was like a brother to her, and he watched over her like she was his sister. When Kyla and I started dating, Kyla insisted I meet Pedro. She actually wanted to see what he thought of me.
If the baby is not Pedro's, then whose could it be?
Calloway asked.
It's not mine, that's all I care about.
Calloway rubbed his chin. Did Kyla give you a reason for your breakup?
No. She just called me one day and said she had been doing a lot of thinking and that it was time we saw other people. I was floored. I thought we had something special between us.
Buchwald's 21. Everyone feels special or important at that age, Calloway thought. Did you know about the money she was going to get when she turned your age? Calloway wanted to push Buchwald's buttons to see if he said something he should not.
Kyla never mentioned it to me, he replied. She didn't like talking about money anyway. I think she saw herself as an average kid.
But you knew she came from wealth, right? Calloway said. Buchwald scoffed.
Hey, listen, I had no idea she was pregnant or that she was going to get a ton of money, and I most certainly did not hurt her, if that's what you're trying to get at. I just liked her a lot. She was a lot of fun to be with.
What was her relationship with her parents like? Calloway asked.
He shrugged.
She got along well with both of them.
What about her father?
From what I could tell, she had a great relationship with him.
Did you ever meet him?
Sure, once. A friend of mine was having a party, and her father dropped her off. We spoke briefly. I thought he was a cool guy. I just never thought he would kill her, you know?
He didn't.
Okay,
Buchwald replied, as if not believing him.
Hey, I better go. I'm kind of late.
Is there anything you can tell me about her that's not on the news? Calloway asked.
Buchwald thought a moment.
They never mentioned that Kyla was a little insecure.
Insecure? What do you mean?
She was always complaining about how she looked. She thought she was overweight. I didn't think she was. She didn't like the shape of her nose. It was a little flat.
Much like Gus Holden's, Calloway thought.
I thought it was cute, Buchwald said. She wanted fuller lips. I thought they were fine. She always joked she would get her uncle to fix her up.
Calloway was confused. Fix her up?
Yeah, her uncle is a doctor. I think he has his own clinic.
Dr. Richard Lester, Calloway thought. Chapter 83. The Lester Center for Cosmetic Surgery was located in an affluent area of Milton. There were luxury clothing stores, designer shoe and handbag outlets, and a couple of high-end car dealerships. A secretary greeted Calloway when he entered the clinic. From afar, the secretary looked like she was in her late 20s, but after a closer look, Calloway saw she was really in her mid-40s. Her eyes gave her real age away. They had a story to tell, and that could only happen for someone who had lived a longer life. Calloway introduced himself. He was told Dr. Lester was with a patient. Calloway said he would wait. He was then told the doctor had a busy schedule and to make an appointment. He asked the secretary to let the doctor know who was waiting for him. If the doctor wanted him to come back at a later time, he would. Calloway knew it would not come to that. He grabbed a magazine and took a seat. The secretary returned and told him the doctor would be with him shortly. He gave her a smile. 20 minutes later, Dr. Lester came out. "Mr. Calloway, I'm surprised to see you here. Why don't you come into my office?" They went through a door and headed down a hall that led to a small room. In Dr. Lester's office, certificates and degrees covered the wall behind an expensive oak desk. Artifacts from all over the world were displayed in the room. Calloway saw an African headdress, a Native American carving, and a religious statue from Thailand.
"I'm glad you've changed your mind, Mr. Calloway," Dr. Lester said.
"Changed my mind?"
"About the photos you took of my sister that night," he said with a smile.
"Name your price, and I will write you a check."
"No, I'm not here about that."
His smile faded.
"Then why are you here?"
"It's about Kyla." Anger flashed in his eyes.
"I know you work for my brother-in-law, and while I commend your loyalty to him, I don't appreciate you showing up at my clinic or my home, asking questions about my niece. Your visit to Sharon really shook her up. You can't imagine what it's like losing your only child. She is fragile, and what happened has really put her close to the edge."
"Close to the edge? She has contemplated suicide, Mr. Calloway," he snapped. "I'm seriously concerned for her mental state." "Paul's also on a brink of a mental meltdown," Calloway thought. "Not that you would care, though."
"And when you show up asking questions, it doesn't help her to move on to the next stage of the grieving process."
Dr. Lester took a deep breath to calm himself.
"What my brother-in-law did has destroyed our family. The way he brutally murdered my niece."
"Alleged to have brutally murdered your niece," Calloway corrected him. "He hasn't been found guilty yet."
"I hear the evidence is overwhelming against him."
Calloway was quiet.
Dr. Lester looked at his watch.
"I am already running behind on another appointment. Now, if you'll excuse me..."
"Please, Dr. Lester, I drove all the way here. I will bill Paul for the hours I put on his case, even if they lead nowhere."
Dr. Lester seemed amused by that.
"Okay, fine. What would you like to know?"
"Did Kyla come to you about getting plastic surgery?"
Dr. Lester's eyes narrowed.
"It's a personal matter.
I'm not sure what this has to do with anything.
I'm just curious." He sighed.
"Yes, she came to me. She complained about the way she looked. She wanted me to remove fat around her waist. She wanted me to make her lips more plump. She wanted me to thin her nose. She wanted stuff that most women her age are sensitive about. They are insecure, and they think having a certain look will help them overcome it. As a surgeon who makes his living on women's insecurities, I will tell you that no amount of cosmetic surgery will make you confident.